My name is Tumi Makhetla. It's the 15th of September, 2009. I'm in Accra, Ghana, and I'm here with Mr. Seth Turkper, who was seconded from the National Revenue Secretariat in 1993 to the Value Added Tax Project as a coordinator. He later became the deputy commissioner when it became the Value Added Tax Service. Thank you very much for joining us as part of this review, set of interviews.
You're welcome.
Before we begin, can I just confirm that we have your consent that this is a voluntary discussion?
Yes, and I've signed to that effect.
Excellent, thank you. Can we start with your giving us a brief overview of your career and how you came to be working at the Value Added Tax Project?
Well, I was working with the then National Revenue Secretariat, which, as many events would have it, was one of the pioneer moves to remove revenue agencies from the civil service and to make them semi-autonomous, out of which we now have revenue authorities, you know, in Africa and other places. And then I had just qualified as an accountant and I wanted to further my education. So I took a leave of absence and went to Kennedy School to do my master's. And on my return, I was told that my next assignment would be coordinator of the Value Added Tax. And so that's how I ended up being coordinator of the Value Added Tax.
Excellent.
And I was taking marching orders.
And when you think back to the first days of your work at the project, what were the main challenges that were identified as priorities?
Well, the main two or three challenges, and the main ones were VAT was at that time not new, but VAT had also, its introduction in Eastern Europe and other places had become associated, you know, with politics. Mm-hmm. And so anywhere VAT was introduced, there was some form of political upheaval, mm-hmm. you know, partly because of the inflationary trends in those places and the perception that VAT, you know, often affected, you know, prices. Mm-hmm. The other challenge was that, unlike other countries, we had sales and service taxes in place already, and we were going to replace these, you know, with a VAT, as in some other countries. And therefore, we were not just introducing a new tax into the system, but we were replacing a tax which required change management, cultural change. And then the third challenge was, by the time the VAT had started, the country was going through some adjustment fatigue already because Ghana had launched the structural adjustment program back in 83-84, of which the National Revenue Secretariat I spoke about, you know, was a part, you know, and the autonomy for the revenue agencies. So we should actually have done the VAT if we were remained on course in 85-86. So starting it in 93-94 was procrastinating, mm-hmm. by which time we were about 10 years into, you know, structural adjustment, and it was becoming very difficult. And then 92, you would also recall, we just moved from military rule to multi-party democracy where everything was being in a more open constitution. So implementing reforms during those, you know, that era was quite a significant challenge for anybody, mm-hmm. with hindsight.
Why was the implementation of VAT delayed?
We were doing many reforms. Mm-hmm. As I said, we were changing the tax policies, quite a number of them, you know, including tariffs, income tax. We were also doing administration reforms, mm-hmm. you know, autonomy. We were improving systems and procedures. So it was just the sheer volume of work that had to be done. Mm-hmm. And then also there was the, judging from those reforms, people had come to understand that we needed to take our time to plan the VAT, as I said, because of, you know, the experiences of, you know, other countries. So these are some of the reasons why, you know, there was a delay.
Okay. And at the time that was implemented, was there a sense that the time was right or ripe for it?
86 would have been right for it. by 93, 94, yes, we felt matured, which is why many people globally were surprised when Ghana couldn't, you know, fail in introducing the VAT for the first time. Because, as I said, we had done major reforms, like taking the revenue agencies out of the civil service and done many, you know, so we felt, you know, matured. We felt it was time to make the change. And as I said, this was something which had been steady for many years. So yes, we felt that it was time to make the change. You know, except that, you know, you need to be ready both technically and politically and bring the public along. And that's where the challenge, mm-hmm. you know, the surprise came from, yeah.
Okay. So when you began to set up the VAT service or through the project initially, you were drawing on pre-existing strategies developed internally or particular experiences in other countries?
Both. We had a lot of experience with reforms internally already. I myself was, as I always say, I was a product of reforms. From the university, I joined the National Revenue Secretariat, mm-hmm. you know, and after my national service. And so we had done quite significant reforms and we're drawing on those, but we're not complacent. So with DFID assistance, mm-hmm. at the time they were called ODA, we got the Crown Agents, which had assisted many countries, Crown Agents of UK, which had assisted many countries to help us, you know, do the programming. And they actually assigned a lot of consultants to work with us throughout the implementation. Mm-hmm. We also had the Harvard Institute for International Development actually designing the policy framework, you know, for the VAT. So we had both internal and external inputs, mm-hmm. yeah, into mm-hmm. the VAT.
What would you say were the key changes that you were involved in during your time at the program?
Oh, quite a lot. As coordinator, I was in charge of, actually, okay, maybe we, to put it this way, we had five elements of the program. Mm-hmm. The first was setting up a project management team with a steering committee, you know, to do the work, to plan the program and report to the minister. The second was organization, which was to look at the organization of the revenue institutions as they were, mm-hmm. and what do you do when you introduce a VAT, you know, which is, in our case, we opted to establish a VAT service rather than integrate it with the Internal Revenue Service. We look at systems, you know, and procedures, what require changes, what new procedures need. You know, VAT is the credit method, so the credit method is new to us. Mm-hmm. We were used to the ring method or deferred method. So that was another, you know, element. And then staff, you know, training was another big one. So yes, we did have, you know, these areas of mm-hmm. yeah, to focus.
And of those, what would you say were the most significant that you were involved in at the time, in the early days of the reform?
I would say public education, which I didn't mention. Mm-hmm. You know, both technical and public education, because you have to bring taxpayers along, those who will be registered for the VAT. You have to bring staff of the revenue institutions mm-hmm. along to make them understand the new concept. And because VAT tends to be political, you also have to bring the general public. You know, some of who will never touch a VAT invoice except when they go and buy, but you still have to make them understand the concept, mm-hmm. particularly that it wasn't going to increase prices, you know, or affect a few commodities only, those type of things.
Yeah. Okay. So before we get into discussing how you went about actually, you know, developing your public education program and your training program, I'd like to ask you how you build support for the implementation of VAT. Who were the key actors or institutions that you considered to be allies as you began to introduce the tact and set up the service?
Well, you can see that from the composition of the steering committee. The steering committee was chaired by a Deputy Minister of Finance, and then we had representatives from the Ministry of Trade, mm-hmm. Communications, the Central Bank. Mm-hmm. But we also had a private sector represented and a consumer society represented on it. So we try to reflect, you know, as many, you know, of the, you know, societal elements that would be affected, you know, by the tax, both in terms of gaining political support, public support, you know, as well as technical support, you know, in implementing a major reform, you know, like a value-added tax.
This steering committee, was this set up initially when the project was set up, or is this after it was reintroduced?
No, immediately.
Immediately?
Yeah.
Okay. So did this, I understand that a stakeholder committee was brought together later. Did the composition of the steering committee resemble that of the stakeholder?
Well, after the first failure, we expanded the steering committee a bit. But there was more consultation. I wouldn't say stakeholders, you know, but more stakeholders were brought into the education process, more stake into the consultative process. Mm-hmm. And then Parliament also came in on board very strongly, yes, mm-hmm. because of the need to take the VAT bill back to Parliament and to have it enacted. Mm-hmm. Indeed, legislation is, the sixth element, which I didn't, you know, mention, policy and legislation in terms of the program outline.
Mm-hmm. And so in working with these other stakeholders, people in other ministries, as well as representatives from the private sector and, you know, consumer groups, did you have to sort of strike any bargains to help build support for your efforts to introduce a tax?
Yes, you always have to make compromises. The ideal VAT is a VAT that taxes all consumption. So in principle, if you have a VAT as a consumption tax, anytime you want to buy any commodity, goods or services, you have to impose a tax. But then you couldn't impose tax on education. Ghana values its education as UK or anybody on basic education, mm-hmm. health, basic health, you couldn't, you know. So you had to then discuss, you know, both with parliamentarians, with politicians, industry lobby and whatever to see the scope, because you also don't want to exempt the whole of education. You know, what is anything can come as education. Mm-hmm. We used to joke that, you know, you can have Newsweek as education, you can have Playboy as education, mm-hmm. magazine. So, mm-hmm. well, you have to discuss these things with parliamentarians, with the legislature, you know, with politicians, the executive, and you have to discuss with industry lobby, consumers who are concerned. Yes, so as with any policy formulation, you really have to make, but you still have to stick to your goals and not make, you know, otherwise in the end you would also erode the tax base. Mm-hmm. You virtually erode the tax base. And the beauty of the VAT is that it's a broad-based tax, and then you can have a lower rate. Yeah.
Can you describe to me how this engagement was structured? So the way that different groups were able to indicate where they would like to be exempt from VAT and how you took that into consideration?
Well, we did expect the representation of the steering committee to be consultative, in that members would go and also consult. But we had a very active publicity and education program, you know, so we adopted various strategies. We wrote, you know, articles, you know, we had seminars, we had training sessions, you know, we even had town hall meetings. We went into towns and villages, you know, and so quite a range of, we had a comprehensive publicity and education strategy, particularly the second phase, mm-hmm. after the first phase, the failure. Mm-hmm.
In the first phase, can you describe, it was a project then, so how was the, what was the weight given to these sorts of activities to build public knowledge of the tax?
Pardon?
When the project had just started from 93, what was the weight given to these public education activities?
We always give a lot of weight to public education and publicity. Issues. The difference was political buy-in. During the first phase, there wasn't much of ownership politically of the reforms. And so much of the work was tended to be technocratic, technocrats moving around. And we have a public service, you know, which is supposed to be nonpartisan. So public servants often felt reluctant, like myself at the time, to respond to political charges. Mm-hmm. But after the second one, you know, the weight in terms of more mass education, you know, as opposed to technical education for registered taxpayers. So I would say that that's the difference. But in terms of the elements, they've always been one of taxpayers, you know, general public, and then the staff. And technical, yes. Those are the key elements of your. But then you waited. We tended to wait mass public education more in the second round because of the sensitivity or the perceived lack of sensitivity in introducing the tax during the first round.
Mm-hmm. And so during the second round, when it comes to these issues again of building support, how did you change your strategy in terms of who you spoke to get greater support?
Well, sorry, I sent you. Mm-hmm. Institutionally, there was a change in that the Ministry of Information and Communications at the time came in, you know, very strongly with a mass public education, you know, plan and strategy, and they took charge of significant elements of that program,
mm-hmm.
which meant that, you know, they recognized the political importance. And I recall working on one of the subcommittees with the current vice president, who was then Minister for Communications,
mm-hmm.
you know, so deputy minister actually at the time for communications. So it tells you how significant it is. So that was the first strategic change. The second strategic change was more outreach by the staff of the VAT service. And more emphasis given to general education as opposed to a seminar, you know, with a small group of registered taxpayers who want to know how VAT affects the oil sector or how VAT will affect the specific. We had to discuss more general, you know, issues, appearances on television and whatever to explain, you know, or on radio to explain, you know, questions. Those that make sense, those that didn't make sense, but you had to respond to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you were sending out people who had been selected for their ability to administer tax to reach out to the public, did that require any additional training, skills development?
Yes. Certainly yes. Particularly for a new tax. You don't assume just technical knowledge, but you have to also recognize that you are not going to meet taxpayers who are all, you know, economists, accountants, you know, even owners of businesses. The owner doesn't have to have qualifications to collect the tax for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you've got to educate him or her in the, you know, language in which they understand. And that's a policy that was perceived to affect, you know, people's pockets, and with pressure on government to increase wages as a result of that, you had to do a good job. So you have to, without politicizing your public sector employees, you had to make them understand the perspective of somebody who was asking questions like, how will VAT affect, you know, the price of bread? Even though the answer is obvious, it won't, because you were paying sales tax, which was embedded in the price of the bread,
mm-hmm.
VAT will come at the same rate, and therefore, as far as you are concerned, you'll be paying, you know, the same thing. But that wouldn't be a sensitive, you know, answer. You've got to understand, you know, that there is VAT also going to cascade, which is one of the charges, you know, against VAT, because it's collected in multiple stages. You have to take mm-hmm. your time to explain, you know, how anybody who is registered, who pays the VAT, they can be given a refund,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all that, yes. So I always tell the story of an elderly gentleman when we were, you know, devising a strategy, and he said to me that he had a simple text. If I could convince my driver, my secretary, and my administrator in the VAT, in the office about VAT, I would have succeeded in educating the public about VAT. Yeah. And on the other hand, if my driver found himself at the end of the day in a drinking bar and they were discussing VAT, and he said, oh, this one is for my boss, it's not for me, then you wouldn't have succeeded.
So what would you say, I mean, you've touched on this, but if you were to summarize, what would you say were the key messages that you were trying to get across to the public?
Well, the key messages that you sent across to a public that had to pay the tax was the benefit of the tax. And then you enter into a tricky area, because as a tax administrator, you are not in charge of how the tax is used. with somebody who is on a spending giant.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've become the face for waste and other. So you've got to explain how the tax which you are collecting from the general public, you know, would be used. You also have to explain, you know, the fairness with which you want to collect the tax in that. And one of the things we said about the VAT actually was that our sales tax back then ended at the manufacturing stage.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still into the retail. And then it was also on specified commodities, and we're going to cover all goods. So even though you are seeing it as covering more goods and services, you've got to send a message that this was desirable, because if you took two people under the old regime, one was buying an item and paying the tax, the other person was not buying. But for society as a whole, if everybody is going to contribute, then everybody must contribute to the efforts in equal measure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so those are some general things, you know, that you, and for the those who are going to collect the tax, you want to make sure that they do it in a very efficient manner. You know, yes.
Were there any unexpected obstacles in your efforts to reach out to the public?
Yes, the demonstrations. Well, the demonstrations and the strong, you know, opposition to the VAT, which from a technical point of view becomes very surprising. You know, though I suppose for many politicians, they would understand where they are. But it had become something, as I said, because of the adjustment fatigue and because of something which it was very easy to blame for many of the difficulties that, you know, the public, you know, was facing. So with a little slip, you know, you have people in the streets and doing all kinds of... And that was a huge obstacle to the smooth implementation of the task, because what it meant is that you were always probably overemphasizing the, you know, general elements of the, you know, of the reforms,
mm-hmm.
than the technical one that would make it, you know, efficient.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned earlier, though, that you had anticipated there might be some sort of social upheaval associated with the introduction of that. How did you attempt to engage that before it became a popular protest?
Initially, we didn't expect it in Ghana, to be frank. You know, we were learning from the experience of other countries that this could happen.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, we felt, you know, we had done many reforms. We also felt that we had done a lot of preparations, and we were prepared with a good plan to introduce the tax. You know, so that's why it became an element of surprise, you know, when we were...
So you were saying that initially Ghana had not expected this level of public protest.
No, not at all. I wouldn't say that. We recognized the need for public education, and we did our best, because, as I said, we were using a very reputable firm of international consultants, the Crown Agents, which had been involved in the introduction of VAT, Harvard Institute for International Development, which was also involved heavily in Eastern Europe, had provided us with some, you know, advice. And we ourselves had done so many reforms,
mm-hmm.
you know, so we did not take reforms for granted, you know, even though we've had, you know, serious challenges with reforms, we've always felt confident, you know, that we could, you know, prepare towards them, and as they came, we solved them.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a surprise, and that's why I said it was, I mentioned it as one of the obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You mentioned the fatigue with reform and those sorts of factors affecting the level of public opposition to the introduction of VAT. Some authors have also suggested that it was because the political opposition at the time was outside of the government and therefore saw this as a campaign to back, because, you know, they were generally excluded from formal politics, but that after 96, their inclusion in the government was one of the factors that there was less opposition. Do you think there's...
I don't think they were included in 96. That's one of the...
Mm-hmm.
In 96, the government won. The government had the majority in parliament. The government appointed its, you know, parliamentarians.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what changed was the government that was better prepared to defend, you know, its policies.
Mm-hmm.
And to date, we still have those two strong factions. You know, from you know, from independence, we've always had two strong, you know, political dynasties, as they call them, the Nkrumah faction. You know, and next week is you'll be in town, I hope, for the centenary, you know, anniversary celebrations. And then the Dankwa-Bosa tradition. And so this is something that goes back a long time. So at any point, you would always have a strong opposition, either from the left of center or from the right of center. So I think a lesson for us was preparing, and preparing well, and not underestimating the opposition.
In the preparations that you made, I understand that that was initially, or the public was sensitized to a VAT figure of 15%, but that it came in 17.5%. Can you explain why that was not addressed earlier, or what do you see happening?
It was addressed. Actually, the sales tax rates, some of the rates were as high as 25%. And we had been reducing them at 2.5 percentage points from 25 to 22.5 to 20 to 17.5 in anticipation of the introduction of the VAT, which was to be done at 15%. So it wasn't that, you know, there was, you know, one rate against, but it was a trend which we were following, because we're going to, as I said, the sales tax had a narrower base, and we're going to expand the base of the VAT, use the VAT to expand the base of the consumption tax. So with the expansion of the base, you know, we had been reducing it. It was one of the reasons we didn't introduce the VAT in 86 also, and 87, you know, to be reducing the rates so that we don't have a sharp reduction in the rate. Now, we had started some publicity, admittedly, with 15%. But then the fiscal figures at the time we had, you remember 95, 96 was also a difficult year globally. Ghana had droughts and others. So the fiscal numbers were not, you know, balancing. And so there was a halt to the reduction from 17.5 to 15. But we had then started printing even materials that suggested that the VAT was going to come in at 15%. So this was the headache, the problem that we had.
When the government decided to repeal VAT in 1995, what was the impact of this decision on the office?
On the office? Well, initially there was the thinking that VAT would never come back, you know, but then we were told that the government was not cancelling the VAT, the government was only withdrawing it to do its homework. So we had recruited beyond the skeletal VAT project. Those staff were put under the Internal Revenue Service. The VAT project itself was put under the, you know, the Internal Revenue Service. The commissioner at the time was the president, the current president. You know, so which I'm always proud to say. And so he was charged with responsibility for the small VAT project until it could be reintroduced. And therefore, after the elections in 96, you know, the program was put in place to reintroduce it. And then so the VAT project was actually never dissolved. You know, rather, we stayed for the whole period to plan new strategies for the reintroduction.
Can you describe some of the negotiations that might have taken place to work that configuration and to send staff into positions they were satisfied with in other
Agencies? The most obvious one was a 10% rate at which the VAT was introduced. You know, you can buy from 17%, you know, 15%, and then 10%. That wasn't the rate at all, too. And then the negotiations that went through that with both the majority side and the minority side. And then a year after the negotiation to increase it, which gave us the Ghana Education Trust Fund. And then after the MPP, which opposed the VAT in opposition, came to power, the negotiations to increase the rate again to 15%, but to allocate the 2.5% for what we now have as a national health insurance, you know, levy. So all these are collected as though they were a VAT. So in essence, you know, we've had the VAT, you know, giving us two very important health, you know, and education funds. So, in essence, we have a VAT rate of 15%. But in practice, only 10% goes to the consolidated fund, and 2.5% goes to, you know, the education fund, and another 2.5% to the health fund, you know, which are very, you know, good initiatives. So that is, that's a most significant negotiation that had to be made. And then also there were negotiations on the base of the tax. Some more education, health, food items were brought into the exemption list.
Mm-hmm. And at what level did those negotiations take place? Who was involved in this?
Well, all levels. Cabinet level, parliament, civil society. So we're all over the place holding consultations with business, civil society groups, and all kinds of.
So if you take one of those, where did the initiative come from? Would it have come from the Ministry of Finance presented to the VAT services, who then presented it to Parliament, or can you describe, the Assembly?
There were various, maybe to cite two or three. You would have, say, Parliament Finance Committee, which was very technical and whatever, looking at a bill and suggesting, that this or that should be done. You would have an academic writing or somebody who is a journalist who had been to UK and seen that there is no VAT on children's clothing and was even zero rated and didn't understand why we shouldn't, whipping up, support through an argument, through an article or, talking on a radio, and then it gains currency, this commodity shouldn't, attract VAT, so you have to explain carefully why it should. Otherwise, it becomes policy. And then you had cabinet itself. We did actually do seminars for cabinet, and they asked questions.